My name is Caitlin Anderson. I'm a member here of Jewish Voice for Peace, one of the co-sponsors of this the other gracious co-sponsors are GoPink. They're also sponsoring the National Forest Fund of State of Health. And AFSC, American Friends Service Committee. All right. So here are Nessa and Maya.
Hi. So this is Netta and Maya, and thank you all for coming to listen to what we have to say. We appreciate it. I think we'll just start and get right into it. So we are here not as individuals necessarily, but also representatives of a group. This group is called the Shmini Singh, or the Shmini Singh Letter. What does it mean? Shmini Singh in Hebrew means 12th grader. That is what we are. We are recently graduated high school seniors who refused to serve in the Israeli army as we were required to do upon finishing school. So some basic facts about conscription in Israel. I'll just elaborate a bit on what Eitan started a minute ago. Both girls and guys in Israel are required to serve. For girls, it's usually 2 years, and for guys, it's three. And this applies to Jews, but not only. There are other sort of minorities that are compelled to serve. And that's pretty much for everyone. And there are many ways to get out of the Israeli military. In fact, today, we are not the only ones who did not serve. Close to 40% of those required to serve, in effect, do not serve today. The vast majority of them, not for the reason that Netta and I chose not to go. And most of them got released in a number of ways. I'll just mention them. So there's the most popular one today in Israel is mental health, by which, in the process, people go to a mental health officer and declare that they have some sort of mental health problem that prevents them from serving, and they get exempted for this. Another common way is through the physical health. People either genuinely have or fake physical problems. There's also religion. This applies both to Orthodox males and females. Therefore, religious reasons are exempted because it is seen as contradictory in some way to their religious lifestyle. So many men, Orthodox men, go to study in the yeshiva instead, and for women, they are exempted as well. And there's also a sort of special status called misfitting, or I guess that's the best translation I could find for it, which is people who either smoke some pot in high school or, just don't really get along within frameworks and therefore were released. Or have socioeconomic problems that prevent them from serving. So these are the other ways. And there's also another special status called conscientious objector status, which Israel, in order to pacify, I don't know if it's the international community or who, but sort of created the status and said we do have freedom of conscience in Israel by creating this special committee exempting people for what's called universal pacifism. So someone applying to this committee will state that he or she is a universal pacifist, would never be violent under any circumstance. In this committee, words like occupation or things that are specific to Israel will not be, you cannot use them if you want to get exempted, because that is seen as selective objection. And that is the category that Netta and I and the other Shmini teams fall under. Selective pacifism is defined sort of as objecting to a specific policy. In our case, the Shmini Singh, we are objecting to the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and this is why we refuse to serve, because we do not want to serve this occupation, which we deem immoral. And that's, I think, the bottom line. So those are the things that we go through. I'll just read you a quote from our letter, which I think summarizes the group's ideology. historiographic, I will say that we got together and we wrote a letter which we sent out to the government, to the chief of staff. We circulated it widely also within the Israeli population. We collected over 200 signatures from teenagers in Israel supporting our statement. And I think this sort of sums up our ideology and our reasons for refusal, so I'll just read the translation of this paragraph. We object to Israeli, quote-unquote, defense methods. Checkpoints, targeted killing, roads for Jews only, sieges, and more, which serve the land-seizing policy, annex more occupied territories into Israel, and trample on Palestinian human rights. These actions are perhaps a temporary fix, but it is clear that in the long run only exacerbate the conflict. It is impossible to harm and imprison in the name of freedom, and thus it is impossible to be moral and serve the occupation. I think that it sort of sums up our group's ideology. And I'll pass it on to Nathanael, who will talk a little bit about the process we go with the military.
Okay. So from the day that your draft day, you're considered to be a soldier. If you're showing up to the base, if you're not showing up to the base, it doesn't matter. So we all came in our draft day to the draft base and said no, we're not going to the army. And from this point, you are being transferred through all kinds of offices and officers, and in the end, you're being judged by an officer. It could be a high rank, low rank. It's not constant. And then they can judge you to between 7 and 35 days, which is the time that is appointed for refusing an order. And this is actually the felony that we're doing. There's no specific felony as refusing to join the army. It's refusing an order because you're already a soldier. So we serve our time in a military prison with other soldiers. In women's prison, most of the prisoners are there for deserting from the army. And of course it doesn't end in 35 days in jail, because when you finish the time in jail, you go back to your draft base, and then you refuse the same order again. So it could go over and over and over between a week to, and the people who spend the most time in jail were 2 years. So we just want to explain a little bit, not only how we refuse and what happened to us, and also why. So Maya's now going to talk a little bit about our reason to be against the occupation.
An introduction. So we don't know how much you do and do not know about the occupation, so if this information seems basic to you, I hope you will bear with us. But yeah, I mean, we just want to talk today about ourselves. We can talk about the occupation and what we are resisting, what we are refusing to serve. So over here, we just have some basic maps. We think it's important. On the left-hand side, you see the 1947 partition plan. This was designed by a special committee on Palestine sent by the United Nations. What's green is reserved for Palestinians, and the sort of yellow is for the Jews. And in the center, the darker area is Jerusalem, and that was supposed to be a, because of its great importance, a neutral territory ruled by the UN. So that was the partition plan. And I'm not going to go into the whole history, but just to mention, this partition plan was very, very favorable to Jews, because while they comprised 30% of the population at the time this map was drawn, they're getting 55% of the land. I'm not going to go into the whole, you know, rejection of it and the independence war / Nakba, but this is what ended up happening. Is that there was a war, and Israel won. And the next map, one right over you see what ended up at the end of this war. So the borders now, what you see on the left-hand side, the little strip, is the Gaza Strip. On the right-hand side, it's the West Bank. And what you see at the border of what now is Palestine in this map is called the Green Line, or the Armistice Line. And this is where the war sort of stopped, and that is sort of what remained of that. Now, on the other two consecutive maps, you're seeing what are considered to be very generous offers made by Israeli leaders to the Palestinian Authority in various peace negotiations. The one on the left-hand side was made by Barak, and Barak's offer is termed the generous offer. I'm not even comparing the lands that he's offering Palestinians as their homeland compared to the 47 one. I'm even talking about some basic things. You'll notice, I don't know if you can see it from there, but you'll notice that this offer does not include Palestine having a joint border with Jordan. It does not include East Jerusalem, which is considered by Palestinians to be their capital also. Does not include a lot of important water aquifers, and it also is arranged in such a way that Israel maintains 7 big settlement blocks within the West Bank, or sort of on the border of the West Bank in Israel, and that's what you see are these little inlets, or rather big inlets that are created there. So you see that sort of, in effect, Israeli settlements are sort of eating away at what could be a viable Palestine with territorial continuity, or contiguity, and the border and some sort of basic autonomy that we would imagine a people desiring a state of their own would demand. So now we're really sort of talking about the 3 main elements of the occupation. We're pretty much dividing it into the settlements, the checkpoints, and the wall. These are the 3 main things that the occupation is really comprised of, and we'll sort of explain a bit about each of these things and why they are obstacles to peace, to a just peace, and to a solution that could lead all of us to have better lives in the region. So, Nick, why don't you start with the settlements?
Okay, so first of all, we're going to start with a short definition. The settlement is what we call to every town, city, some kind of place that people live in behind the green line. Behind, you can see there, all the blue dots are settlements, while the from the other side is inside, is from the other side of the green line. And the lighter blue dots are outposts. We call outposts to everything that is a place that there is people living, but it's not legal by the Israeli law. Places that the government doesn't recognize as legal, but yet not doing any steps to evict users. Okay, so when we talk about a settlement, who lives there? It's not necessarily people that are right wing that want to maintain the Israeli occupation in the West Bank. Lots of times it's people that are only looking for good life quality. It's cheaper to live there, it's cheaper land, bigger houses, nicer view, and better life quality. And then there is, of course, the ideological part of it. You can divide us to security and religious. The religious people are obviously want to maintain the land that we got as Jews, the father's land. And on the other side, there is the security ideologist that claims that the settlements are what protects Israeli borders, and this is why we have to stay there. It's important to say that since 67, there weren't any Israeli government. I'm sorry?
My question is, what are the 2 dots there?
Those are the settlements. The Israeli settlements is in Palestine, in the West Bank. This is a close-up of the West Bank. Yeah?
On the right? what grade are you? So yeah, what for the synopsis, what's relevant is to look at the blue and big are all the settlements spread with things.
The gray are the big passing entities.
Great. Thanks for
cutting off my stuff. So there was no single government that stopped building settlements. So to say that the settlements are only encouraged by right-wing people is will be a lie, because since 67, and 67 was a left government, they were always building, and never the percent of the settlements or outposts that were evicted was never more than the percent of building. So that means that even during our generous land-giving plan, we were still building all the time. So we would give in one hand and take from the other. So what are the goals of the settlements? First of all, you can see that they are usually in very strategic places, places that prevent the Palestinians from having a consistency in the places that they sit. You can see between the gray dots that are Palestinian cities and towns, there are always blue, which is the settlements. So I'm gonna give it back.
So that was the first element of the application, right? We talked about the settlements and what they are trying to achieve. So like as I said, they're trying to seize more land. As much land as possible. Some of them see themselves as sort of continuers of the Zionist vision. So what helps enforce this? We talked, Linda also spoke about the connection between settlers and the government. It would be a mistake to think that settlers are this sort of extremist group doing things against the law. The government is complying, not only by building, but also by providing the security that these people need in order to live in a very hostile environment, which is Palestinians that are not so appreciative of their presence there. So how do they do this? They do this by telephone. I don't know if you can see so well, but all of those red triangles are all checkpoints. And you can see the checkpoints correspond very nicely to the settlement. What does this teach us? This teaches us that the checkpoints are there to protect the settlements, and they are there adjacent to the settlements, and they correspond to them. So the settlements specify the checkpoints as well. Now these checkpoints, you think that, often, I don't know if you've heard these arguments made by some Israelis, but they say, well, these checkpoints are important for our security. I mean, maybe they are harder than Palestinians, but we have no choice. If that is so, how come they are not on the border between Palestine and Israel? How come they are separating Palestinians from other Palestinians? And that is, in effect, what so many of these checkpoints do. They're in the middle of Palestinian land, and they separate children from their schools, students from their universities, patients from their hospitals, farmers from their land, and relatives from each other. So I'm sure you've all heard about the many hours that Palestinians spend standing in checkpoints. And this is also the place to say that Israel, recognizing that it rules, who rules the West Bank is the civil administration and the Israeli army. It is not the democratic government, obviously, and Palestinians have very little say over their lives because people ruling them are not elected by them or responsible for them in any way. So Israel, recognizing that there will be an uprise of Palestinians against this occupation, has devised a very clever system, an effective system, by which to control the fence. And these checkpoints are very crucial in terms of controlling the fence. Because Palestinians now rely in an occupied territory on a very complicated system of permits, which are very hard to obtain. If they want to work within Israel, if they want to visit someone, if they need to go to a hospital, all of these things require permits. If you want to get a permit, you have to be paid. If you join an organization, Israel disapproves of. If you join an uprising, you will not get these permits, or the people close to you will not get these permits. So Palestinians are terrified of uprising and claiming their rights because of this system, and checkpoints are part of that. Now, it's just important maybe to talk a little bit about who mans them, because it's relevant to our refusal. More and more checkpoints are being managed by private security companies, but But that's not always been the case. In fact, usually not the case. And now it's sort of changing to that. But primarily, the people manning the checkpoints are soldiers around my age, with guns, probably 19, 20-year-olds, who are standing there day and night, like along with the Palestinians, for many hours, whatever the weather, often with heavy equipment on their backs, and a lot of responsibility. Often there have been terror attacks in checkpoints, soldiers have been hurt, and checking a Palestinian and doing strip searches isn't that pleasant for the soldier either. This is not something that that is natural to ask a 19 or 20-year-old to do. It's a lot of responsibility. It's very hard on the soldiers. It wears them out very much, and a lot of times this wearing out leads to disgraceful behavior, to abuse that you hear of Palestinians. It's not because they're evil. It's because they are scared and because they are standing there, and this is a lot of responsibility for them also. So this is unjust, not only for the Palestinians, but also for the Israeli soldiers that are made to stand in these checkpoints. So I think I explained sort of what checkpoints do, what are the effects that they have. Now I'll pass it back to Nessa to talk about the third element of the occupation, which is the wall.
The red line that you see over there, that was the checkpoint first, is now the wall. If you see it compared to the green line, you see the green line is not exactly straight, but it also doesn't walk like a drunk snake all over the place. And the red line, which is the wall, is. So what is the reason? The reason is to take as many settlements that we can into the other side, into Israel, and that is not security, because if we wanted to do the most secure line that we could do, we would make it the straightest possible, not going into the settlement. This would require more work, more building, more money. This is not security. This is ideology. And when we're talking about specific, because the struggle against the wall became something that is really famous around the world. People heard about it. People heard about specific villages, Bilin, Yalin. I'm sure some of you heard those names. And when we talk about specific stuff, for example, if we take Bilin's village, this is a village that more than half of the farm, the lands that the farmer used to work on were taking. And they were taking not to protect Israeli citizens. They were taken to protect potential settlers that doesn't even live there, in houses that doesn't even exist. The wall there made to protect buildings that are still in process of building, buildings that it's not necessary to have them there. This is not security now. We're talking about protect people that are not even exist. And the most famous group that is active against the wall is Anarchists Against the Wall. This is a group that is active with Palestinians in a non-violent joint struggle. And this is really important to emphasize, the fact that this is a non-violent struggle. Well, you probably saw the videos, and you can see stones that are being thrown on soldiers. And we still call it a non-violent struggle. And not because we want to lie to you and tell you there's nothing there. Because when you see a kid throw a stone at a soldier, and that could be dangerous, it could hurt the soldier. But it's not as dangerous as rubber bullets, as tear gas, as concussion grenades that are being thrown on the people, on the civilians, in this village, every Friday. And this is a struggle that more than 20 people have been killed during those demonstrations since 2005. And that is not something that's supposed to happen in demonstrations.
One person I was meeting in Canada, from Canada, in Israel, not too long ago, asked me a good question. I think she phrased it very well. She asked me, so where is the money in all of this? And I think, and you're laughing, but I think there is money. There so often is money, and there is money here too. It's not just politics, and I think that showing the political aspect is showing only part of the picture. So I want to talk a little bit about what we call the economy of the occupation, because there is an economy of the occupation. So it's sort of divided into four main parts. The first one is economic exploitation. of what? Of Palestinian labor, products, resources, and sort of creating a captive market. So what do I want? I'll sort of break this down and elaborate. So in terms of Palestinian labor, like I said, because of the wall, because of the checkpoints, Palestinians can't be very picky in terms of where they work. Because the civil administration of Israel rules the West Bank, they are very lax on labor laws. That means they get often less than minimum wage, get no compensation for injuries that are brought on by their work, and Israeli companies, Israeli organizations, as well as international or multinational ones, definitely exploit the Palestinian labor very, very much. In terms of resources, well, Israel treats West Bank sort of like its backyard. That means it dumps toxic waste there, and because there's no one to really object, there's no authority or government to say you can't do this. And it also extracts things, and it actually steals Palestinian natural resources. If it's mud from the Dead Sea, I'm sure you all know Israel's infamous Ahava products. If it's water, if it's mining, all of these things, Palestinians cannot have a say in it, and they just extract all of these things and steal it from Palestinian land. Same with products. Israel, because Israel controls the checkpoints that are the entry and exit of Palestine, Israel exclusively controls the Palestinian market. And it reaches an absurd situation in which a Palestinian can buy a product from an Israeli or international company for cheaper than he or she can a product from a neighboring village. Why is this? Again, because of the checkpoints that Israel puts up. And Israel also decides which companies can sell and which companies can buy from Palestine. So if Israel gets paid money from a certain company, it can decide to eliminate any sort of competition with this company. And therefore, Palestinians have to buy a product from one company exclusively because Israel decided this is the only company selling this sort of product in Palestine. And the same goes for export of Palestinian products abroad or to Israel. So this is something to understand. But Israel pretty much has full control over Palestinian economy. And this is not very helpful for Palestinians who wish to create a country of their own. And of course, you all know that a big part of a country is also an independent economy. So that's about the exploitation. And there's also the control of the population aspect. I mentioned before, checkpoints are being manned often now by private security. In Israel, private security companies are a huge business. Every cafe or mall or store has them. It's sort of a remnant of the intifadas, where we had bombings in Israel. And private companies are also greatly profiting from this. There are people making money from manning these checkpoints. Same for construction of the wall. There are architects. There are workers. There are a lot of different people making money from this. As well as specialized equipment. Israel, I'm not even going to talk about Israel's arms trade, which is huge, huge. But I'm not going to go into that. But in terms of equipment, what we call in Israel security equipment. Israel has a good name in the security equipment world. We often sell products. I'll just give one example. There's a computer device in Israel that analyzes a person's body motions and then analyzes what is the chance that this person is a terrorist. These sort of technologies invented and developed in Israel and are used in checkpoints or in Palestine are then sold abroad. And Israelis say, well, we know what we're doing. Believe us. We've tried this on Palestinians. It works. Buy it from us. This is a huge industry. There are countless other examples. I just gave you one. And so it's almost a grotesque use of people's misery to make money. And that is the sad reality of that. And then there's two more things are the settlement products. Gush Katif in Gaza, back in the day, which were a huge exporter of flowers and vegetables. Similarly, now in the West Bank, there are a lot of products that are being farmed or produced on settlements or factories that are working in the West Bank and that are selling their products not only to Israel but also abroad. So that's something to be aware of. And also services of settlement, if it's roads, if it's infrastructure, all of these things, again, people are making money off it. And not only Israeli companies, also multinational companies, and also international companies, and also American companies, and we'll get to that in a bit. But so I would really like to do is to refer you to this great website that the Women's Coalition for Peace in Israel have created, and I've been involved in this project. It's a great project. And it's the website is www.whoprofits.org. And what this website is doing is looking at who profits from the occupation. And it has a list of all the companies that have been well researched. We assure you the information on there has been verified before it's put on there. And you're welcome to look and see maybe what companies you could be buying from that are profiting in some way from the Israeli occupation. So that's about the economy.
Okay, so we talked a lot about how the occupation affects Palestinians, and this is a really sad subject that I bet you're already exposed to it once or twice in your life. But I don't think lots of people hear about why the occupation is bad for Israel. As an Israeli, it's really important for us to say that too. So I'm going to start with the violence. What you've seen here is many different ways to express violence in the West Bank. And this will be stupid for us to think that someone who has experienced this much violence, who had to be so violent to other people, will come back and say, well, I'm going to leave my violence or the violence that I experienced in the West Bank and come back to Israel and be a normal person. Because after you service for 2 years, 3 years, I've seen it on my friends, that they come back and they don't act the same. It changes you. And I'm not saying that everyone who came back from the army is starting walking around beating everyone on the street. But it is something that affects the way you think, the way you live. It's something that if you worked in oppressing and humiliating people for a long time, like soldiers are asked to do or command to do in a checkpoint, when you come back to Israel, you can't just leave it all behind you. The other subject is women in Israel. What our role as women in this patriarchic organization? Because the army is an organization that's based on power and on the differences between sexes are very, very clear there. You will see much more men in higher ranks than women. And when you go back to the civil society, it doesn't just go away. Every time you have to present yourself, you have to apply for a job, you're going to use what you did in the army. And women often do less jobs or less good jobs in the army, and they find it harder to find good jobs, especially if you see it in politics. The Knesset now in Israel, I don't know what the equivalent is. Okay, the Knesset now in Israel has about 10% women inside, or 15%, and that's sad for a democratic state. It's disgraceful.
Other aspects that we see, racism is very much on the rise in Israeli society. We see it in the way we behave towards migrant workers, towards refugee seekers from Sudan. Racism, not only towards Arabs or Palestinians, racism in general, and it's really sad, and I think we certainly see the links from the occupation, the Ethiopians, a lot of different minority groups. Also, again, I know I'm talking about economics, but if you look at just money-wise, Israel is the third country after Pakistan and actually you, the U.S., in terms of how much the percentage of our budget that we spend on security or army. And that's really sad. Israel used to be a really strong welfare state. We used to have excellent healthcare system and great education system. A lot of these things are going down the drain right now because we don't have the budget. And there's a lot of single-issue voting. A lot of people, if you ask them in Israel why they vote for a party, it's solely for the stand that party takes on Israel-Palestine issues. No one even remembers what sort of social democracy is or what different education agendas are out there. People don't even pay all this attention to all of these important issues. They all get pushed aside because the big issue is security that we're all so obsessed with. And the last thing is democracy. Similarly, when you take, like Netta said about violence and chauvinism, if you take people in the very, very crucial stages of their development, you know, ages 18 to 22 or something like this, and you expose them to a system in which they are discouraged from thinking as individuals. In fact, they're almost forbidden to do this. They are told to obey orders. And they can't think for themselves. They can't think critically. They are doing what they are told. To expect these people then to go back into civil society and be effective citizens in a democracy is absurd. Because they've gotten used to this. And you're seeing this more and more, this sort of thinking in groups and lack of critical thinking and lack of individualism that's slowly taking over the country. And this is all because this is such a militaristic state and the military has such a strong effect on our society.
And lots of people are accusing us for being traitors because we're here and we're talking to you. And I just want to say that when we talk about all the stuff, all the violence, the sexism, the racism, we're not talking about it because we hate Islam. We are here because we want to live in a state that is a feminist state, that is a state that wants equality for everyone who's here, that a state that is not a violent state. And I think that we're coming here in this rally not because we're going to try to make everyone in the world hate Islam. We want to come back to Islam, live in Islam, raise our kids in Islam, maybe. And this is the rest of our life, and we're not coming here to make people hate Islam.
Yeah, on that note, sort of, we want to talk a bit about the Israeli narratives, because while it seems fairly obvious, a lot of these things from an outsider's perspective, within Israel, this is not the case. The Israeli narrative, I think, we just want to share that with you because we are Israelis. I certainly came from this narrative. I grew up on this narrative. I believed this narrative wholeheartedly until only 4 years ago. And I want to talk about this narrative because it will help you also to understand where Israelis are coming from. It's not that we're just equal people. We have a certain mentality that sort of blocks us from seeing a lot of these things. So what are they? Well, first of all, the basic premise for most Israelis and probably most Jews abroad, but I don't know about that. I'll speak for Israelis. Is the world is a hostile place for Jews. The world is an anti-Semitic place. The Holocaust is just one of many examples. And Israel, and more than that, a strong army, is preventing a Holocaust from happening again. And this is our only chance. This is the last place Jews could ever turn to should the country they live in now turn against them at some point. And the Arab world hates us. The Palestinians want us out. And we just have to protect ourselves lest we be removed from the face of the earth. So that's the sort of basic thought that's in the back of all of our minds all the time. And it's very hard to shake free of that mentality. And also, the way we're taught it in schools is sort of, I mean, we are taught that Palestinians were there, but there are sort of all these expressions like making the desert bloom. It's sort of as if our grandparents came to this vast, empty desert land and just redeemed it from its barren nature. This is not really the case because there happen to be Palestinians living there already. A lot of time, this sort of quite important fact is not acknowledged enough in our narrative and in our discourse in Israel. Also, Israel is sure that it is the most moral army in the world. You'll hear a lot of Israelis saying this. Also, when confronted with our refusal, they say, how could you refuse to serve in the Israeli army? It's not the U.S. army. It's the most moral army in the world. And a lot of people are very sure that this is true, well, we're not going to get into why we disagree maybe a bit later. And also that all of the wars that Israel, and there are a lot of them I'm sure you hear on the news, that Israel keeps on engaging in are choiceless wars. Ein Bera, we say in Hebrew, we say we have no choice. We are peace-loving people, the Jews. We would love to sit down and talk. The Palestinians are not cooperating, and therefore all these choiceless wars are thrusted upon us. And all that we are doing is really self-defense. Operations like Operations Cast Lead in Gaza Strip are also seen as acts, believe it or not, of self-defense for the citizens of Sderot. And so basically Israelis keep on repeating this much to themselves, and also we say, we want peace, there is no partner. And what we in the Shemitim like to say is, well, if there's people on the other side, there's probably someone you can talk to, you just have to try. And Nessa, do you want to talk about how this is enforced?
So, let's say I was a prime minister, and I would like to make people agree with what I'm thinking. The first thing I would do is go to the education system. And when the state and the army are the almost exact same thing, the education system is very available. So when I was in ninth grade, for example, my class went to shoot guns and in a shooting range. And the best shooter got a sticker. It was very, very exciting for everyone. And I actually didn't go because I thought that shooting is not a social activity. After that, my report card said that the girl is refusing to come to social activities in school. So late in the past 3 weeks, I think, our Minister of Education decided to make a step in upgrading our education system and give more money to schools. Sounds good, right? But the fact is that he wanted to give more money to schools that produce higher draft percent. And not only to the school itself, also to the teacher. So if you're a teacher and you have 30 out of 32 people in the class that are going to the army instead of 25, you're going to get more money at the end of the month to your own pocket. More than that, we wanted to share with you a piece that was on television 2 years ago after the Lebanon War, and the draft percent was the lowest draft percent that has ever been in Israel since the beginning of the draft. And yeah, I want to show you the video and then we'll tell you about it.
But just to explain, what you're going to see here is a bunch of Israelis in Hebrew, but they're subtitled. And just a little on text, Israelis after the army go to either India or South America and smoke as much drugs as possible. And that's sort of their way to get over the trauma. And this is very common in Israel to do. And this is sort of, kind of that this was
I was talking about the army, I was in the Air Force.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. She was a machete cash. The problem with soldiers.
Oh, okay.
He was in Golani. And he was the Achi.
Okay, so this was in TV and on most of the buses, at least in Tel Aviv. So this was a campaign that meant to give a higher motivation to go to the army after the lowest draft percent that I've ever been in Israel.
There's another example of a sort of democratic law that's being trying to be passed recently in Israel. Is the Nakba law. The Nakba is the word Palestinians use for what we call the 48 war or the victory. The Nakba means the terrible thing that happened, pretty much. That is, namely, that they got evicted from their homelands and many of them were forced to leave Israel and have never returned. And many of them live in refugee camps or in the West Bank now in not so great conditions. The Nakba law is basically forbidding people to commemorate the Nakba to discuss it. This is a classic way for the Israeli government to help disregard the Palestinian narrative and even enforce it upon the Palestinian Israeli citizens, who also should have a right, I think, to tell their story. But Nessa, do you want to talk about your profile?
Yeah. Okay, so. There's not many of us who are against the occupation and or maybe more precisely against the militarism in the Israeli society. And one of the groups that is very active inside the Israeli society is a new profile. This is a group that their main goal is to raise questions about the army. Because if you didn't live in Israel, then it wouldn't, maybe you can't understand it, but like, you go to college after high school,
we go to the army. And there is a very, very clear track in life. You go to elementary school, you go to high school, you go to the army, and then you go to India or to South America. You go to university, you get married, you have babies, all of this. But the most important thing is the army is existing in the middle, and it's not, for most people, it's not a proactive choice. It's just what's going on. What we did is a political choice. Most of the people, for them, it's an automatic choice. It's not a political choice. So this group is creating a youth group that are raising the question, talking about it. Not necessarily don't refuse, not necessarily not going to the army, but talking about it, thinking about it, criticize the natural thing to do.
And maybe a little bit more about organizations. There are more organizations in Israeli civil society. So this will be the first table. It's the only ones. There are more, but the ones we chose to put up here are the ones that we are working for or involved in some way. I would like to mention the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. I'm a tour guide for this organization. I think it's very good. You can check out the website. And this is another example, similar to Anarchists Against the Wall, of an Israeli organization, Solidarity with Palestinians, helping to raise awareness, to tell the story, to sort of shift the debate or sort of help to refocus it in a new light, saying that there is an occupation, saying this is a political issue, and raising awareness to it. We give tours in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. That's what I do as well. And we sort of try to do lobbying both in Israel and abroad. Also, another more human rights approach or humanitarian approach, there are many organizations like this that take the more sort of human rights approach. One of them is Rabbis for Human Rights. That's actually where I work full-time. And this is a Jewish organization founded by rabbis. It's actually, by definition, it defines itself as a Zionist organization. And this organization is basically saying human rights are also what we feel that the Torah preaches. And we are going to try to help Palestinians obtain the basic human rights that they deserve. So a lot of what we do, for example, is help them with the olive harvest that's coming up soon. We go there and also this is all nonviolent work, of course. We go there and physically protect them by standing in between them and soldiers or in between them and violent settlers coming to harm them during their agricultural work. We escort shepherds. And we try to bring water to the villages that the army cuts off the water from, and we try to supply them with the basic humanitarian aid that they deserve. Those are some other websites and organizations we're mentioning. I think we're done. So we'll really be happy. This is the part that we like most, is to actually hear from you. Questions, comments, whatever you want to say. And feel free to disagree. I stress, as I know there is a plurality of opinions in the audience. Jewish, Israeli, or whoever you are, if you disagree, please, we will be happy to hear what you have to say. Really, do not hold back.
The question is, I'm sure you've got your hands on this for you. That's a very individual question. My parents support me, which is for my parents. They weren't happy. No one's happy to see his daughter in jail. They weren't happy to see me going against the, holy cow, we say. And it was hard. Someone just told me to do this, like coming out of the closet. I wouldn't compare it. This month, but it is really hard process because it's talking to them and the one who did it, the one who were in the army, and both of my friends were in the army, and saying, I think you are wrong, and I think you sacrifice trees, and my dad is with us until the age of 45, so 3 years and then a month every year since then, from your life for a month, it's a great cause, and I think we did a mistake, and this is something that is really hard to accept. Even seeing the emotional level, his friends have died, my mom's friends have died in war. This is something that is really hard to accept, and I appreciate them so much for being next to me and supported me in coming to visit me there. And, you know, and no one ever agrees with everything, but I think that it's important to keep being supported, even in your kids, even if they do something that you don't like.
Yeah, I don't want to add. Yeah, I mean, my parents also had a very, very hard time with my decision. They were very not accepting at first. But yeah, I think, like Nata said, when I was in jail, they became just parents. And they came to visit me, and they put politics aside. Yeah, but it's not an easy process. But, you know, sometimes parents grow with children, and that's an interesting process to see.
Very
bad question. Yeah. We also have a huge amount of voice. This question is, how unified are Palestinians, are there any questions? Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, I know Palestinians in the audience. If anyone wants to, if a Palestinian here wants to comment on that, we'll be happy for your input. From my observation, Israel has done a good job in also helping. You know, it's a complicated question. I don't want to speak on behalf of the Palestinian people because I'm not Palestinian. But as an outsider, I can say yes. There are fractions that don't work so well together. Israel also contributes to this. Israel has been giving a lot of money to the Fatah for many, many years, and it's sort of been creating this elite that the Fatah is today. The sort of elite society, very disconnected from the average Palestinian, and Hamas is really more seen as grassroots. I think that's also why they were elected in Gaza. They're much more grassroots, and they're much more sort of from the people, for the people, and a lot of people know that Abu Mazen and a lot of people in Fatah are sort of seen as traitors and are seen as people that Israel sort of nourished and brought up and paid money to. So I think Israel also helps this, and I think internal strife within Palestinian society is very helpful for Israel as well. It helps also control dissension in another weird way. So we're not blaming only Israel for this, but yeah, I mean, I think like any society, there's this fragmentation.
The question is, how did you come to reject the Israeli narrative and change your mind?
Personally, I went to the West Bank and I saw what's going on there, and this is not what they told me all my life. I saw how soldiers are shooting innocent people. I went to a checkpoint. I've seen how hard it is to stand there. I read, I learned, I opened my mind. And I think that if you read and if you learn what we learned and combine with experience, some of the stuff, of course, no matter how much I would be in the West Bank, I would still not feel the suffer that a Palestinian living there will feel. But it gives you an example, and combining an intellectual open mind and experience, I think you can stay with the same opinions as you were before.
I grew up in Jerusalem, and I went to, my parents are not religious, and they're generally pretty liberal about a lot of things, but I went to a religious school. And about half my classmates were settlers, often from very, very ideological settlements in the West Bank. And as a kid, I had been to these settlements on playdates, of course not recognizing or realizing sort of what the implications of them were. There was a second intifada, actually, that got me questioning. It was terrifying living in Jerusalem at that time, terrifying, absolutely terrifying. There were bombings many times a day, and it was not an easy experience being a kid there. Jerusalem received like 40% of the bombings overall. But I started understanding, I was about 15 at the time, this happened, and I started to realize that I had very little, if any, political consciousness. I didn't read the papers. I didn't really understand why this was happening, or why this war was happening. After I saw bus explode, I was kind of really shaken from this experience. And I felt like I needed to talk about it. I needed to figure out what is going on. And then, it's a long story, I'll make it short, but I joined a Palestinian-Israeli dialogue group for people from Jerusalem. There were six of us, six Palestinians and six Israelis. It was a very intimate group. And through this group, I met a Palestinian girl who told me a story about what some soldiers did to her father. Now, knowing what I do now, I know that these stories are so prevalent. At the time, I had no idea. And I thought it was like this very weird story. I mean,
soldiers doing something immoral? I mean, that was totally out of the question for me. Because, like Nessa said, it's our fathers, it's our friends, it's our cousins, it's everyone we know. Everyone was, at some point, a soldier in Israel. And so for me, imagining these good people that I know could do something immoral was completely shocking. I couldn't fathom it. And it took a while and a long process, but I started asking questions as well, like Nessa was talking about. I started going to the West Bank. I became active in peace initiatives in the West Bank. And going to the West Bank, not to visit my friends in the settlements, but actually staying inside of things, was really shocking for me. I was blown away by how much I didn't know. And eventually, I reached a point where it became obvious to me that the only moral option was to refuse, because the occupation was immoral. And that's pretty much my story.
I realized that our billions of dollars of aid every year probably spent primarily on the wars and weapons, but I want to give the attention to our aid in the building of the wall. And secondly, I heard about a boat that was trying to take relief workers to Gaza, and there was a Carmen Christian from the U.S. on the boat, and I know you heard it, but I don't know whether it happened to the boat. Do you know anyone else?
Most of it goes to the weapons, but there is parts that are going to the wall, although the wall has been building with a private company, that it's not the state building it. So there are lots of private companies, U.S. companies, that are earning actually money from the building of the wall.
About humanitarian aid. I don't know if many Israelis would agree with me when I say this, but I would ask you, please condition it. when you give us all this money, don't just say do whatever you want with it. Say do with it certain things, and you cannot do this and this and this, such as building settlements, expanding outposts, building a wall on Palestinian land. All of these things would be good conditions. When you give us all this generous money in military aid. I think what Nessa was referring to is also Caterpillar. I'm sure you're familiar with the company. It's also profiting greatly from the wall. So it's just something to think about.
Well done.
Okay. Hello?
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 Hello? Hello? Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Hello? Hello?
We didn't say don't do the wall. We said don't build the wall next to the settlement. We said don't steal land. We want to build the wall, do it on the green line. We didn't say that, dude. What's your comment?
Clearly not. I think the Israelis are trapped, though, in the sense that we have to. And I think that relieves, it's a convenient thing just to believe, because it kind of relieves you of a lot of responsibility, I think we have to recognize that we do have a choice and that we're making that choice all the time. I really appreciate your concern for my security. I lived in Jerusalem, and as I said, I experienced many bus bombings, and I can tell you as a child, living there, it was really terrifying for me, and that's why I said this. I'm not saying that some Palestinians have not done very bad things to Israel. They have. Terrorists are not exactly moral people either, and they also cause death and destruction and fear and anxiety, and my life as a child growing up in Jerusalem was very, very difficult because of this, and I appreciate you bringing this up, but I am also concerned, like you, for my safety, but like Nessa said, the wall and checkpoints are separating Palestinians from other Palestinians more often than they aren't divorcing, if you will, Palestinians from Israelis. Divorcing Palestinians from Israelis will be much easier to do. Just build a wall on the green line, take the settlements out. The settlements are justifying military presence in there. And what often Israelis don't realize is the connection, and I didn't either, make this connection between the occupation and terrorism. The Intifada, the second Intifada, or the first Intifada, didn't arrive in a vacancy. And I know that a lot of you, and that you will probably say, let me guess, you're going to say, well, in 48, way before the occupation, the Palestinians didn't want us there already. Yes, I know this argument, and I will say to that, that, sorry, I'm going to have a conversation with them. I'll be happy to have your response. But what I will say to this argument is that I think it's a mistake, in the same way that it's a mistake to look at Israeli society today and look at Israeli at pre-48 Israeli society and say, these are the same societies. They're not. They've changed so much in terms of ideology and their way of thinking and what they have come to recognize and what they are and are not willing to compromise. They're saying, well, for Palestinians. Pre-48 Palestinians are not the Palestinians of today. Many, many Palestinians, just like many, many Israelis, are very happy with the idea of a two-state solution. And I also want to say that even though we painted a sort of bleak picture of Israeli society, polls still show that 70% of Israelis do want a two-state solution. They do. They do. And they might not recognize that we are jeopardizing this right now, but they do. And so, and the same goes for Palestinians. Yeah, you want to first one? Yeah.
We lived there in that sense. We, because it was our homeland, well, it was our security. We had relatives, the grave of our ancestors are there. In 1948, what happened? It wasn't terrorism. When we sent troops here to Iraq, to fight in Iraq, and the Palestinians fight for their rights, they're not terrorists. Those people were under oppression for those years. Their land was confiscated. We were driven out of our land. We couldn't see our relatives. I went to Israel in 2006 for the first time. And there I saw my cousins, whom I left as teenagers, and now their grandmothers, as I am. I went to my home. My aunt was a very wealthy woman in Jaffa. One time, I was in Israel. When the occupation happened, I was there. When Nazareth was taken, I was there. And I was separated from my parents. We lived very good life for that. My father was a teacher in Jerusalem. He taught mathematics in high school. There was an institute called the Arab Center for the Middle Eastern Arab Studies. It was run by the British government. Asa Irfan was a teacher there, and he was a colleague of my dad. We lived a wonderful life, and all out of a sudden, we found ourselves disturbed, homeless, and fortunately, we were educated. We could go, and we had someone in the United States or in Europe or, you know, to sponsor us. But how about those farmers who suffered? Their land were occupied. And I never forget in 1948. I keep saying this about King David Hotel. I remember that day very well. My father, I remember going to 150 people, Palestinians, who were at King David Hotel. There was a British office there, and they were there. And so during Menachem Begin, They called it freedom fighters, right?
Yeah.
When those weapons, when those bombs were put in that building and those people were killed,
Fortunately, my brother was there, but he was absent. He had sick leave, so he didn't die. But his friend, a young man who came to visit us one time, he was under trouble. My father went from one funeral to another, from one funeral to another. I was going to school in Jerusalem one time, and the bomb, a truck was, there were explosives in a truck. In eastern Jerusalem, there was a market there for the farmers who bring their produce. And one day, in the milk cans, there were bombs there. Menachem Begin and his group, for those bombs, they were exploded, and people died there. Is that freedom fighting?
No.
Is that terrorism or not? That's what I call terrorism. That's what it is. I'm sorry. Now I listen to this. What can we do? What else can we do? And you bring those people who don't get to see anything good at all. They show their homes demolished, living under rubble, and they say it was a desert. No, Palestine wasn't a desert. We came up, we had so many educated people. We had doctors, engineers, professors, and we lived a good life. And all of a sudden we were portrayed in the Western world that we are terrorists. I'm sorry, I do not accept that. And I appreciate you.
Thank you for sharing your own story.
That's very helpful.
Good. Sorry, and just to answer back to your point also, I'm sorry, what is your name?
Rob.
Hi, Rob. Just to answer your other point as well. So, like Shisu ultimately said, also terrorism is not only a Palestinian thing. There's Jewish terrorism, there still is. I can show you some of my good settler friends, actually, who I grew up with, who do terrible things that I consider terrorism as well. But the point being, yes, there was Palestinian opposition to Israeli presence, and a lot of times this opposition was violently put forth. And that is not something I agree with, for sure. But if you and I really care for my security, I think that we have to adopt a totally different frame of mind. I think that we have to work for peace, and we have to work for reconciliation, and we have to negotiate. And Israel is not doing all of those things, or any of those things. It's continuing, building settlements continuously, it's flying in the face of any sort of possibility for two-state solutions. And I think that's very selfish of Israel to be doing. And I think what we need to do is give peace a chance, take those settlements out, yeah, and give Palestine a chance to prove itself as a country of people who want to live alongside the Jews in peace. If that doesn't work out, we'll figure out what to do then. But right now, the occupation is only causing people to be more violent. Oppressing people daily and humiliating them, that's what's causing the violence right now. I assure you that if Palestinians with good lives, they wouldn't be so compelled to put... Because, you know, killing yourself is a pretty serious thing to do. It's a way of no return. And I'm sure that if someone has a good life and his human basic human rights are respected, he is not feeling so compelled and so easily manipulated into doing such terrible acts of violence. And that's what we have to understand.
Does anyone have questions that are not related to the discussion? Or you want to keep doing this? Or... move forward. So,
no, but other comments that are of disagreement are very much encouraged. And Rob, if you have anything else, we'll be happy to talk to you also later on.
I have become aware that, as you have said recently, the two-state solution is becoming less and less likely to change to a one-state solution. Equal rights within Israel and rights as Israeli citizens and a secular country, a secular Palestine where religion is not given special rights and where they're all part of the same community. Thank you.
Okay, so first of all, I would like to say that our group, the Sunnisim, doesn't have a solution. We are against the occupation and we're coming from very, very different points of views about this. The solution, and I can tell you my personal belief. my personal belief is that I don't want to live in a religious state. And for me, a one-state solution will be just as good as two-state solution, where everyone can live in an equal society. And I want to live with my boyfriend without anyone telling me that I'm assimilating. And I want to live in my state and be able to get married and get divorced and get whatever I want the way I want without anyone telling me that I have to do it by the way of God. Okay? So there is different things, there is different ways, and I'm telling you, in this place, when I live in Israel, I don't care. Give me one state, give me two states, just let's do something that will make it go forward and not going backward. And what we're doing now is going backward. Ben, sure. Next row. Yeah. Okay. So I was going to start with your second question. Because Israel likes to step back. When Israel withdrew from Gaza, they didn't want to do it talking to Palestinians. They didn't want to negotiate. They wanted to make a stand. Make a stand that will be seen in the international community. Make a stand that will make Israel look better because we're leaving a Palestinian-occupied territory. But it didn't make a change. The people in Gaza live now much worse. Like, they can go to the West Bank. Their whole families, they can't even see each other because they can't go to the West, from the West Bank to Gaza. They are still under military control. If you're saying the military did leave Gaza, but Gaza is now not a functioning place that is good to live in. Gaza is now much worse than what it was before the disengagement. And I was against the disengagement from the left point of view. What we created is a place that is surrounding itself and can't function at all as an independent area. We are controlling everything that goes to Gaza, the electricity, the water, the food, the aid, everything. And this is not a good solution. And when people voted for Kadima, they didn't vote for peace. They voted for Israel making a stand.
Okay, I will disagree with you on this, because though we're the same group and we feel the same way about the occupation, I personally see the answer to this as slightly different, and that's fine, we're both individual people. My answer is this. I do believe that life polls still consistently show that the majority of Israelis have come to their senses in the sense that they do realize that probably the best solution for both peoples would be a two-state solution. I do believe this. And I do think that a lot of Israelis genuinely, when they voted for Sharon back in the time, were supporting this idea, and I was very happy for this. I can tell you a little bit about the Israeli narrative. As far as the Israeli narrative is concerned, the situation is as follows. We give Palestinians something, the Gaza Strip. We go towards them and we're giving them such a generous thing, and what is the response? They shoot rockets back at us. How ungrateful is that of them? And my what is less mentioned in the public Israeli discourse is that the second we left, although the occupation per se is not there in the sense of the settlements are gone, there was a siege on Gaza. And there's collective punishment. You can say, yes, well, the Palestinians are blowing up the tanks or blowing up the checkpoints and they're making their lives harder. True, that was probably not necessarily wise as far as the Israeli response that followed. But there's collective punishment constantly practiced on Gaza. And in terms of humanitarian and human rights terms, Gaza is a disaster zone. And so I think that if this engagement would have succeeded much more, and maybe the platform of now Gaza, later the West Bank, would have been carried out or would have succeeded more if the Israeli public was more aware of more facts and didn't see this as, sort of ungrateful or ungraciousness on the Palestinian side. That's what I would say to that. So what was your first question was?
What was
a response. Well, that's the thing. I think it's a complicated answer. My answer is this. The second and first Intifada, they broke out in response to a sort of long silence, and I think I ask myself, well, is it better if they would renounce violence? Would the Israeli public respond positively and say, and have more trust in the Palestinians? Because it's true, there is a trust problem, there's a trust issue here. Israelis don't trust Palestinians, they think they're out to get us. So, wouldn't it be better if the Palestinians would renounce violence altogether and would really sort of have a completely non-violent struggle? Maybe it would work, but I can tell you that during the peace agreements, like I said before, the settlement and facts on the ground and occupation were continuing all the time. Those were not lifted. And the intifada, both the first and the second, broke out as a response to the frustration of Palestinians, I think, feeling like nothing was going on. And the second intifada broke out after the failure of the peace agreements, because the Palestinians saw Israel talking peace and building settlements. Talking peace and building roads to new settlements that are not even built yet. And the Palestinians are thinking, well, this is kind of hypocritical. And they're sort of right. And so I think that if you're looking at Palestinian mindset, sorry, I'm really talking, well, I'll finish this short to the point. But as far as I see it, Palestinians, when they're quiet, no one listens. When they're violent, everyone denounces their violence and says, how dare you be violent, and then uses violence to justify really intense military actions. So it's like they can't win. Because when they're quiet, we ignore them, we continue the occupation. Because you know what the problem is? The occupation is too goddamn comfortable for Israel. And that's the problem. Is that you can live in Tel Aviv, you can live in Tel Aviv and not know what's happening. And a lot of Israelis, if you compare to Palestinians today, still live the good life. We live in our comfortable Western bubble, okay? And except for an intifada here and there, we have it good. And the Palestinians don't. Okay, you have to go off and you have to finish it. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, I think that what's happening in Israel is horrible, and I would never want to live like people have to live here. But I think Israel shouldn't avoid taking responsibility for what's going on there. Because during Gaza, there were much more rockets and there were much more people who died than in those 8 years together. So, I mean, with the people who died, not with the rockets. So, I think that we can say that people in Gaza don't throw rockets because it's fun. They throw rockets because they don't have anything to do. They don't have an army that can go and from their state and fight against other soldiers. All they have is to attack civilians, and it's wrong. And I'm against it. And I certainly disagree with the way of violence. This is why I didn't go in the army. I believe in nonviolence. Strategy. But I think that if we want to make the people that living in Israel more comfortable, we shouldn't just say, wait till the Palestinians will say, maybe we'll try a nonviolent way. We should say, we have to protect those people and create peace.
Go ahead.
Yes, I was allowed to answer you. And there's
not as a group.
No, we don't know the group, as an individual. Yes, as an individual, I work with Palestinians, people my age. And the response has been very good, but of course, they like me and not as old. It's easier for them, I think. Because I think they understand that I identify with them a lot, and I identify with their cause and their suffering. So I think it's the first force for them to do it. And do you want to do other questions?
Yeah.
I was on the street and I understand your security, but I kind of would almost want to ask you, what is your solution? Because
witness what's going on there. I'm not a soldier, and I didn't stand for 8 hours in the check line, and I didn't got the I didn't have to train like that kind, and I didn't go through a lot of stuff that they went through. I didn't have to fight in Gaza. And I think that lots of times the response is, you should go there. You should let yourself out, and then you can
I had nothing that was leaving Gaza in a way that would allow for searching, and there are mistakes being made on both sides. Let's be clear on that. I think there was a waste of a lot of resources that were left there personally. I think Canadians could have used a lot of what was left there and maybe didn't. I won't get into, but you know, for me, I feel more comfortable criticizing my own society because that's what I am responsible for. And before I point fingers, I look at myself, you know? And I don't know what it's like to be a Palestinian, but I know what it's like to be an Israeli, and I know what I would like my government to do and the moral standards that I uphold my country to. That's what I want to say.
The way that the people who left Bushkas left were evicted from Bushkas safe living today is a really important point. This is another example for how our government, using the money that they have to continue the occupation instead of helping the people that really need it. I was volunteering in a tent that was built in Tel Aviv after Bushkas safe, and I've seen those kids leaving their house, and it's horrible, and it's hard. And it's not their fault that they had to do it. It's not their fault that they had to leave their house, at least not the kids. They didn't choose to leave there. And the fact that the government is not helping them now is really disgraceful. But if we're looking at a long-term solution, Israel is now doesn't agree to sit and talk without premise conditions. And I think this is saying we are not the partner. Because we don't want to sit and talk to you before you agree to this and this and this and this. And the basic demands are also ridiculous. Saying, I don't want to talk about Jerusalem. Which Palestinian would sit next to you in the table and saying, I don't want to talk about Jerusalem? There are people living there right now under occupation. Why would they want to talk to you if you don't want to talk about their home? And I think that this is the first step, and this is something that we don't do right now. We're not going to talk. And I didn't say, well, tomorrow I want to stop and take all the military out and take all the settlers out in one day, and that will bring peace. No. I think we did lots of work in the West Bank in the past, at least since 67. That will make this solution be impossible, because we don't trust each other, neither Israel and Palestinian, or Palestinian and on Israel. And we need to start with negotiating and be prepared to a big settlement in the future. But what we need to do right now is at least freezing them, because we don't do that. Even though there is some international pressure now in Israel, we decided we don't want to freeze the settlement. We want to keep building them. And this is not security. Even if you don't want to evict what is there right now, why would you want to keep building it if you want to have a two-state solution?
Okay, you Right, about what you talked about, the 348, did you guys hear the question? Yeah. Look, I think both peoples were, in effect, trying to seize as much land as possible, Palestinians as well as the Jews, also before 48, and let's be clear on that. It's not taught to us in that way. Yeah, that's true. And an interesting fact about the Green Line, the party in charge of the education system, the party which has the education file, is much more right wing. The previous one was from the Labour Party, and she was the first one. It was a very controversial move to insert the Green Line, right, the internationally recognized border of Israel and separating Israel and Palestine, into Israeli textbooks. So I think it's really interesting that Israelis were studying the 67 war, because that is in our history textbooks, and the 48 war. Certainly, all these wars that the Green Line is very, very relevant to, without studying the Green Line and its significance and the fact that Palestinians and the international community recognize it as the international borders of Israel. So that's an interesting fact. Yes, there is a lot absent from our textbooks. That is for sure. I'm sure there's things in the Israeli narrative absent from the Palestinian textbooks, and then that's just any country. I'm sure there's a lot of things about Vietnam that are not in your textbooks either. So, you know, I think every country tries to cover its trails nicely. And I want one more question, maybe? You? Yeah?
How would you designate society equality that you would want without allowing Palestinians and their descendants
Personally, I think it's not. But problems are not really solved. I mean, we can try to reach to the best situation that we can reach to right now and say the problems are solved. This is what the U.S. did with the Native Americans. The problem is not solved. And they live in reservations. They didn't come back to where they were, and that's a problem. And the problem with the Palestinians, maybe it won't be solved. I personally, yeah, I support the right of return for the Palestinians. But this is something that is not, I think it's not the first thing that should happen. Because when people live in refugee camps, I think the first step is to make their life better than to make them perfect, and to give them a possibility for better life quality before we're talking about actually solving the problem from the root. Because what we have is a critical problem that is now. And I think we should give it an immediate solution.
I just want to say something. This is, again, I said I wasn't going to speak to the Palestinian society, and I still won't, but I'll say that while the Palestinians sort of waive the sort of right of return a lot, many of them are very, very open to negotiating the actual return. But let's be clear on that. The right does exist. If you look at, if you respect the UN and international law, the right of return exists according to the 194 resolution. Okay? And that's just a fact. Whether Israel chooses to acknowledge this part of international law or not is another story. The right exists. Okay? If you respect international law.
You want to say something?
But I think
it's not exist.
In what sense? Can you elaborate on that? I think, okay, the 194 resolution of the UN on Palestine and Israel says that all Palestinians will be allowed to have the right of return if they wish to live in peace with their Israeli, with their Jewish neighbors. That is the clause. Now, you could argue that maybe many Palestinians will not actually want to live in peace, and that's another story. But if you look at that resolution, I've read it many times. Let's talk about it in a bit. But that's what the resolution states, and it's a UN resolution. So, I mean, in terms of that, if we're talking about in terms of rights, that's the right that's just out there, okay? And whether Israel acknowledges it or who acknowledges it in the international community, that can be debated. But it's been written by the UN. What I want to say is, like Nessa, I think the right of return isn't, a lot of Palestinians would be willing maybe to give up the right of return in terms of not right now, or maybe ever, if they were properly compensated for this. If, you know, like this woman said, they lost their home in Yafo. If the Israeli government paid them or built them another home somewhere else, in Palestine, in the West Bank, and wherever they choose, maybe they would. I know that a lot of Palestinians that I've met have told me this. They have told me I'd be willing to give up the right of to not return to my original pre-48 home if only I would get compensation, if I could live in the West Bank and in my own country. I mean, there's a lot of different ifs to that. But I don't think necessarily that all Palestinians are determined to return to their pre-48 homes. They just want a country of their own, and they want to live in dignity in some sort of way. I really think we have to come to a public decision.
Yeah, go ahead. You do that. So that was the last question. Thank you for coming out. And I also want to recognize each of you. The Seattle chapter of Being Political Peace is currently coming to you over the years, and we appreciate the information that you shared with us and the passion that you brought. Thank you.